Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme is the World Health Organization's International Health Treaty. My guest is Dr. Meryl Nass, NASS. You've probably heard her on many different programs, watched her on television, because she is an internationally respected physician and scientist. She's an internal medicine physician in Maine, prominent medical activist who specializes in treating patients with Gulf War syndrome. And that's the first time I met her 30 years ago. We had a conversation on this, in fact, several, on my WABC show and also on WBAI. She talks about adverse reactions from the anthrax vaccine and vaccine safety and efficacy in general. In the past, she has testified on 6 separate occasions before Congress on behalf of veterans suffering from the causes of Gulf War syndrome. Meryl became a major voice during the COVID pandemic in exposing the failures and contradictions and the untruths in the narratives of the federal health agencies and the orthodox medical establishment. She's opposed vaccine mandates and the false claims and fear-mongering about infectious disease epidemics and corruption within the medical-industrial-military complex. Last year, due to the criticisms of the handling of the pandemic, the Maine Medical Board, for purely, in my opinion, political reasons, accused her of spreading COVID misinformation by treating patients correctly and safely and effectively using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, and for that they suspended her medical license. Hearings are still being conducted in her case. She works closely with Robert Kennedy Jr.'s Children's Health Defense, and she serves on the board of the Alliance for Human Resource Research Protection. That's a nonprofit organization run by Vera Sheriff that advances medical ethics that uphold human rights and protects humans from wrongful medical interventions. Her work is cited in many professional articles and publications. Oh, by the way, she also holds a degree from MIT, and her medical degree is from Mississippi School of Medicine. Her website, where she blogs, is anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com. Nice to have you with us today, Meryl.
Thank you very much, Gary. Let me just say that I'm not keeping up that site anymore because I've moved to Substack. So MerylNass.substack.com is where you'll find my up-to-date work.
Good. Meryl, this is a very complex issue, and I don't want to rush through anything. And most people are only vaguely familiar in the field that there's an effort by the World Health Organization, including just this week, of creating a treaty that will allow them total power over every decision made, every product used, including vaccines or drugs, and its enforcement in over 196 countries. And these treaties supersede sovereign laws. So if you have a law saying that you don't have to do something, and the treaty says you do, then you do. And this is a problem. And yet all these countries that are supporting the World Health Organization are not looking at the downside. And these are being sponsored by China that has helped control the World Health Organization. In fact, they were responsible for getting the current director in. And the U.S. is also supporting the World Health Organization. So first, tell us why you're concerned about the World Health Organization expanding their surveillance powers. And they've been working on this since 2005, shortly after the first SARS outbreak. So if you were to look at the World Health Organization, most people probably have an idea. It's a very important organization created by the United Nations, and it's meant to look at the big picture. If an outbreak occurs in Zaire or in the Congo or some other country, what is the operation going to do to help control it, contain it, and eliminate it? We don't think of our local agencies being able to do that. You want something that's worldwide. So they have a good image, but then you open the door and look behind the curtain, and it's not so good. Take us on that journey now, please.
Okay. I'm going to talk about then what the WHO is doing at the moment, and then I want some time to go behind that curtain and talk about how the WHO has basically been co-opted to as a mechanism to gain control of nations around the world, and that there's something behind the WHO, and that even if we got rid of the WHO and got rid of the current two treaties being negotiated, we would still be left with a massive architecture for global biosecurity that has been put in place over the last 20 years. So let's get back to the WHO, which is funded primarily since Biden came in and gave, you know, put us back in the WHO and gave them about 600 and something million dollars for their two-year, they have a two-year budget. The United States, Germany, and the Gates Foundation are the three largest funders of the WHO. And China has increased the amount it pays in also. So most of the money going to the WHO is actually voluntary money, not assessments. That sounds great. You know, the countries have to pay smaller assessments, but all the voluntary money comes with earmarks. So as a result of that, the WHO has itself been putting it in place over a number of years, this biosecurity, biodefense, biosurveillance architecture. What happened in 2021 is that there was an interest, probably the United States was the key player behind it, to create a pandemic treaty that all 194 nations that are part of the WHO and two other small nations that sort of sit with the WHO but are not officially part of it would be bound by, and that would describe the conduct of nations and the WHO in the event of pandemics that would be declared by the Director General of the WHO. So a pandemic treaty was drafted, drafts were begun to be written, and they go through a long process of many different committees with, you know, people from many of the countries on those committees. And after a while, it was decided that treaty didn't sound good and maybe they should call it something else. So they called it an accord. They don't know if that's a good name. So now they call it an instrument or an other. It seems like the reason for the changes in verbiage are possibly an attempt to sneak it through without a two-thirds vote at the WHO or even more importantly, without individual nations having to ratify it. All right, so that's one document, a pandemic treaty of some kind. There's a separate document, which is a total change in the existing international health regulations. They first came into being in 1969, and they just said, you know, they were guidance documents, what to do in the event of outbreaks that affect more than one country. And in 2005, they were amended considerably. And so those are the international health regulations we have now. However, even though the WHO and some others are trying to claim that they were binding beginning in 2005, which means countries were required to go along with what the WHO said, I and others believe they were not binding, that they were purely recommendations at that point. So now we are dealing with considerable amendments to the existing international health regulations. Over 300 potential amendments were put forward by dozens of countries. And there are, again, many committees, several committees that are responsible for trying to harmonize all these recommendations or amendments and create a new document out of them. The problem is that the original versions of the amendments took out probably the most key part of the existing health regulations, which was freedom of persons, dignity, and human rights. Okay? They simply took that language out of the health regulations and replaced it with fluffy words that have no real legal meaning and do not protect human rights, such as dignity, equity, inclusivity, and sustainability. So that was the first tip-off that something bad was happening. In addition, there is an extensive surveillance mechanism put in place. And this is surveillance not only of microorganisms, but surveillance of people and surveillance of narratives. So if the director general declares a public health emergency of international concern, what would go into effect immediately is that nations would be obliged to monitor the media and social media in their countries and censor anyone who is putting out information that was not consistent with the director general's narrative. Okay, so we saw that with COVID. We saw that go on. We saw the United States government spend probably billions of dollars to enforce its narrative. And we're now just starting to dig under that and find out what happened. And yet in the IHR amendments, we're looking at putting this legally into place and imposing it on 196 countries. You're also looking at the vaccine passport. This is part of the international health regulations that are being proposed, that there will be passports, that there will be requirements for crossing borders in the event of a pandemic declaration by the WHO. And there'll be a lot more, there'll be a huge, very expensive infrastructure built up to manage all of this. And it has to be built up at the international, national, state, local level. So you're looking at something that has been postulated to cost $100 to $200 billion just to put it in place. And then many billions of dollars every year from the world community thereafter to maintain it. And this would be a public health apparatus, which may be a good thing. It would be a whole lot of genomics. So while they don't really, they carefully don't distinguish between looking at the genomes of bacteria and viruses and people in these documents, there are hints such as that countries don't need informed consent to share genomic data. There are hints that they're looking to collect the genomes of lots of people, maybe everybody on Earth, because bacteria and viruses don't care whether there's informed consent to share their genomes, but people do. And so by bringing in the issue of informed consent, we see that there's something more insidious planned. There are other provisions that are likely to be thrown out because they are not in agreement with industry, such as the fact that the WHO director general could commandeer intellectual property and manufacturing capacity in one country to produce medical materials that might be needed in another country. Anyway, that's sort of a basic description of some of the most egregious provisions that have been proposed so far. There is a 1 to 2 year process of completing these documents and getting them voted on by the members of the WHO. And that entity is called the World Health Assembly. So the WHO is the agency that carries out the directives of the 196 member World Health Assembly. That group generally meets once a year, although during the pandemic it has met additional times, but it's planned to meet this May and in May of 2024. And at one or both of those meetings, they will be voting on the amendments to the international health regulations and to the new pandemic treaty. Last year, the United States tabled or gave the WHA, the World Health Assembly, 12 or 13 proposed amendments. They provided them 4 months in advance of the meeting, and they did not get buy-in from enough members. And so when the meeting began, the United States withdrew all but one of those proposed amendments. And the WHA voted on it last year and approved it. What did that amendment do? It sped up the process of putting new amendments or a new pandemic treaty into effect. So up until last year, countries had 18 months to think about whether they wanted to be part of a pandemic treaty or whether they wanted to be part of the new international health regulations, and they could opt out within 18 months. That process was reduced to, I believe, 6 months. At the time, it was said to be 6 months. One author has said 10 months, so I'm not certain. But anyway, the time in which a nation can opt out is going to be limited. So the process is to put these two documents, to complete them and put them in front of the World Health Assembly and then put them into force has been speeded up considerably. And it seems to be simply part of bringing into play the Great Reset. Now, let me talk about one part of these documents, which is called One Health. And so the documents claim that the World Health Organization and its nation members need to follow the One Health approach. One Health is a concept that was dreamed up by somebody 20 years ago, but it had no traction. And then 10 years ago, it was introduced at Davos. And CDC picked up on it. And the federal government has put a lot of money into creating a One Health infrastructure around the world. So there are many hundreds of veterinarians and public health professionals who think they are now carrying out One Health objectives, have been paid to do so. So what are those objectives? One Health claims that human health cannot be looked at in isolation, but must always be looked at in the context of animal health. So livestock and wild animals, but that's not enough. Also, it has to be looked at in the context of plants and waterways and ecosystems. So One Health has basically hijacked the entire world and everything in it and claimed that they all are part of One Health and that the WHO must look at health from this global perspective. It's not only about protecting people's health, but protecting the health of the ecosystem, of the livestock, of the wild plants and animals, and the water. What this has resulted in is some theories and documents that are so insane that they are hardly to be believed. And yet I'm going to tell you that this is a method by which humans and everything we own are to come under the purview of the Director General of the World Health Organization. In January 19th through the 21st of this year, The Lancet, which is probably the most widely read medical journal in the world, The Lancet published a series of articles on One Health, six articles in total, five or six, and an editorial. Now, I'm going to read to you from that editorial. Quote, "The notion that the well-being of an individual is directly connected to the well-being of the land has a long history in indigenous societies. Nowadays, the term One Health has become an important concept in global health. The One Health high-level expert panel defines One Health as an integrated, unifying approach that aims to sustainably balance and optimize the health of people, animals, and ecosystems. It recognizes the health of humans, domestic and wild animals, plants, and the wider environment are closely linked and interdependent." And then it goes on to say, "One Health goes way beyond emerging infections and novel pathogens. It is the foundation for understanding and addressing the most existential threats to societies, including antimicrobial resistance, food and nutrition insecurity, and climate change. Modern attitudes to human health take a purely anthropocentric view." In other words, a view that is based in the needs of humans, or the viewpoint of humans. "One, that the human being is the center of medical attention and concern. One Health places us in an interconnected and interdependent relationship with non-human animals and the environment. The consequences of this thinking entail a subtle but quite revolutionary shift of perspective. All life is equal and of equal concern." They go on to say that this requires a complete change to our relationship with animals. Of course, they want us to go to a plant-based diet. "We furthermore need to, quote, reduce human pressure on the environment. And that by taking a fundamentally different approach to the natural world, one in which we are as concerned about the welfare of non-human animals and the environment as we are about humans. In its truest sense, One Health is a call for ecological, not merely health, equity." Okay? That was published 6 weeks ago in The Lancet. This is the utter nonsense that is being used to basically lower the value of humans in some global perspective. Would you like to ask me any questions now, Gary?
I wanted to hear what your overview was, because, again, it's extremely complicated, and they'll put a good face on it, and they'll have the whole media around the world praising it. But the reality is these people have failed miserably with every epidemic that we've faced, and they are complicit with the World Economic Forum, with Anthony Fauci. They're complicit in lying. They're complicit in not being transparent. And we wrote a devastating article, all true and completely scholarly, that's on GaryNull.com, Richard Gell, myself, exposing. We wrote an article on the FDA, the CDC, Merck, Johnson & Johnson. We wrote on Pfizer, on the World Health Organization, showing all these organizations are interlocked. They have tentacles that one person goes to be an advisor on one, and then suddenly you see that you have a consortium of power. And so they control the message. If you go against their message, you can be fined. In some countries, in Canada, they're not allowing demonstrations where you actually protest. They say that a demonstration is fine, providing that what you're demonstrating against does not ask the government or any of its policies to be changed. Well, then what the hell is a demonstration if you're going to go out there and all just sing songs? No, you have to protest. But Trudeau, that does not have the same constitution in Canada as we have in the United States, they don't have a First Amendment, freedom of speech. We saw what he did to the truckers. We also saw the following lies. And all these lies have been proven now irrefutably to be lies that cost 7 million people their lives, 1 million Americans. I'm going to go through these and tell you why I do not want any organization that is purely political, and that's the World Health Organization, to be in control of our choices, our freedom of choice, because they're talking about having control over your body and the choices you make, and they will allow no dissent. Let's just look at this, and if I'm wrong on any point, challenge me, all right?
Okay.
With COVID, they said that COVID, remember how Fauci did all that he could, including put an article in The Lancet with a group of supposedly respected scientists saying, oh, it wasn't in a lab, it was from nature, trying to make it seem like it came from a wet market. And virtually his entire protocol was based upon, let's not look at a lab, it didn't happen there. And secondly, we don't fund, and he doesn't fund, as the top person at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, any gain-of-function research, all lies. We have emails showing that from the night that this broke out, he was on the phone with people who said to him, because we had the emails, Congress has the emails, so it's no longer guessing, it's not redacted. They're saying this came from a lab. Within days, 3 days, all these people had switched 180 degrees to where, no, it came from a lab. But these same people suddenly were getting multi-million dollar contracts from, you guessed it, Anthony Fauci. Is that in any way a collusion? Well, that's what the courts will ultimately find out, and all the testimony coming under oath will help us better understand that. But we know that that happened. We also know, according to the former director of the CDC, who's a virologist, by the way, he's an MD and a scientist, he said just 2 days ago, under oath, before Congress, he said that he was kept out of every single meeting that was important. He was not allowed to see information that came in. He was excluded. And when he brought this to their attention, hey, I'm the head of the CDC, right? Why am I not being heard? Why is my advice on the president's COVID task force, why am I not getting a chance? Because he did not align with their program. So he was excluded. And then he was attacked. All right? He was attacked, for example, in one of the major papers in the country for being a racist because he said that the virus came from Wuhan in China. Well, that's correct. It did. That's where it came from. But that showed you that they were already seeing that he wasn't on board. So the head of the CDC was able to have told us the truth, but he was excluded from having the truth at his hands. Then we were told the following. Not a problem. We've got this under control, but everybody must be obeying because everybody is equally susceptible, from children to teenagers to young adults to middle-aged people to older people, all equally susceptible. And we have to have you tested to make sure if you have the virus or don't. So they used a test that was created and won the Nobel Prize by a friend of mine. And he's a professional friend, did a lot of interviews. In fact, the most watched interview he's ever done was in a documentary I did in 1996, Kerry Mullis, who invented the PCR test. And he very clearly said, don't use my test as a diagnostic tool. It's not what it's for. It has a lot of good uses. It amplifies, but it's not for diagnosis. So what did they do it? They used it for diagnosis. As a result, and you'll see in his discussions, if you have amplifications beyond, let's say, 23 amplifications, meaning you keep enlarging it, beyond 23, you're just dealing with junk. You're dealing with cellular debris. You're dealing with old viruses, new viruses, dead particles of virus. But you can't affirm that a given single virus is present and what it is and if it's pathogenic. It doesn't do that. Yet that's exactly what we were told it was for, even though the test itself says don't use it for this. So people lined up of all ages to get their test. Well, lo and behold, how many repetitions and cycles was it being used at? About 41. Even Anthony Fauci publicly said beyond 23 cycles, you're not going to get anything that's legitimate. Yet he didn't tell all these manufacturers of the PCR test, what is your amplification? Don't go above 23. Do it at 20. No, it was 41. So literally, at least 95%, if not higher, of all the tests were going to create false positives, meaning you were told, oh, you got the virus, when you didn't. And people had no symptoms and were told, you got the virus, go home, stay locked in. And that was the justification for the quarantining. Then we were told that this virus is spread on tops of counters and hands and in the air. And so therefore, you don't be around people, wear masks. And then we were told masks were absolutely going to block this. Well, I did a simple check of the size of the micron size of the virus against the pore size of the mask. And lo and behold, the mask does not prevent these viruses. Now, that's been confirmed by the Cochrane Group, the most respected independent scientific group of scientists in the world. And it's also been independently confirmed by multiple other scientific resources. Plus, I also did a show showing you the danger of wearing cloth masks and even other masks where the fibrous material will come off and go into your lungs and will not get out of your lungs and can cause fibrosis and other conditions in the lungs, and how breathing back in carbon dioxide was dangerous, not having enough oxygen going below, let's say, 21%, which is dangerous. And the mask did that. And here you had children wearing them nonstop. You had athletes in soccer games wearing those damn masks, creating deprivation of oxygen to the brain, as well as carbon dioxide buildup in the body. Dangerous, creating oxidative stress. Now we see that that was true. That's been proven true. There has been a stake through the heart of that lie nonstop. And yet, people were condemned. People were arrested. A guy in a kayak in the ocean, Pacific Ocean, alone, with no one in sight, was arrested. A family on an empty beach was arrested. A woman sitting in a bleacher watching her son, an empty bleacher outside, son perform an athletic on track, was arrested and manhandled and tasered. We went crazy in the wrong direction. We were wrong. Then we were told, the New York Times led this charge, that if you tested positive, you were a case. Case means clinical manifestation. Not true. And now we know that there was, in all of America, there was a 1% fatality rate. Okay, what about if you were under 70 with no comorbidities? Well, then it was 0.03%. I see. So what about a normal serious flu season would be? Yes, around 60,000 people dying, yes. But suddenly there was no flu, no deaths, none, zero, not a single death. Well, that's not possible. And when you're getting anywhere from 39 to 70,000 deaths per year, you suddenly have zero. It was being recategorized. Then hospitals wouldn't treat you. Doctors wouldn't treat you. We had effective early stage treatments. You were one of the doctors saying that there were FDA-approved drugs, terribly safe, that you could use and that would save a life. It interfered in the replication process and stimulated the immune process. Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, monoclonal antibodies, steroids, azithromycin, different antibiotics. So whatever the condition was in the body, you could have right then and there stopped this whole damn pandemic. But Fauci said, don't do anything because we want gain of function. Emergency use authorization to get this vaccine through. Well, the FDA's rules state that if you have any other therapy that can prove as effective as the drug or therapy you're creating, you cannot get emergency use authorization, meaning you can't fast track something. You have to go through the 7 to 10 year period. In 7 to 10 months, they got this through. No animal test and no real human test, no long-term studies at all. And they hid the evidence. The evidence was devastating. They lied about everything from miscarriage rates to myocarditis. And then we started to see an 1,800% increase in the deaths of young athletes. No risk factors, no smoking, no drinking, no heart disease, boom, dropping dead. And yet the mainstream media never once covered any of this. So all these people started to have side effects, and then they started being excluded. No reports going in. We talked with doctors in the emergency room. We talked with nurses. They said we were told, don't fill out any of the adverse event reportings. It takes too much time. And they didn't do it. Morticians started showing up with bodies they couldn't embalm because of these self-organizing nanoparticulate lipid stringy materials in the arteries and veins. Again, nothing until the pathologist like Dr. Cole got involved and said, wow, this is a whole new phenomenon we've never seen in the history of human beings. The media didn't touch it. The CDC wouldn't talk about it. And again, it was all nonsense. The therapies that did work, I collected over 500 peer-reviewed studies from the Library of Medicine on ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine alone, and yet you wouldn't know any of those existed. They attack the people who are saving lives and praise the people who are killing. Is anything that I just said inaccurate?
No. Let me elaborate on the cycle thresholds of the PCR test, because that's very confusing for people. So a PCR machine is a method, or the technique is a method for creating many copies of something that you're interested in. You want to find perhaps a 20 nucleotide long segment of DNA or RNA. So how do you do that? You have a template, you have something that looks like the opposite, and you have certain other reagents that you can use, and you have a machine that gets the temperature of your solution hotter, colder, hotter, colder. And each cycle that the machine goes through, you attempt to achieve one doubling of this 20 nuclei. If it's in the sample, you keep trying to double it by having your template find it and build a new one. And so what the CDC did was say that in order to identify a breakthrough case, in other words, a person who had COVID, even after they were fully vaccinated, CDC didn't want to find those cases. So they said, well, you can only report those cases if they had a cycle threshold of 28 or below, which meant 28 periods in which you could have potential doubling. So a rather strict requirement. And in addition to requiring a cycle threshold, in other words, 28 or fewer cycles to be performed, in addition to that, they needed to either be hospitalized or die. And then you could report them as a breakthrough case. But if they were unvaccinated, you could report them as a case of COVID if they had a cycle threshold up to 45. In other words, you can take, you know, their saliva or their nasal secretions and attempt 45 times to double it. Why do you go through this process? Because you can't detect that little chain of nucleotides when there's only a few of them. There's no known way for man to detect it. But if you double it, then you get enough so that it's detectable. And so CDC created these absolutely different criteria so that they could lower the number of vaccine failures. You know, they called them breakthrough cases, but the old term was vaccine failure. You know, you're vaccinated and you get the disease. And they made the cycle threshold so high for cases that were unvaccinated that even if you didn't have COVID, you would be, because of the vagaries of this PCR method, you would have lots of false positive results. So that is what the CDC decided on May 1st of 2021. And to my knowledge, they have continued that, which has allowed them to publish every day in the New York Times that there are 6 or 8 or 10 times as many unvaccinated people getting COVID as vaccinated, when in fact, essentially the reverse is true. If you're vaccinated, you have become more susceptible to COVID than if you're unvaccinated. And this is my contention, is based on data from many other countries. Okay. If you want me to go back to the WHO.
Let me just hold on a second. I just want to summarize or try to summarize what you had said very quickly. So what we have is we have a very corrupt, completely non-scientific, and totally unreliable World Health Organization that should be completely disbanded and something new and non-politically and financially motivated group of scientists who truly know what they're doing take its place. The new format of this treaty is to expand the World Health Organization's surveillance powers. Now, mind you, they work hand in glove with the World Economic Forum. They'll expand the definitions of pandemics and health emergencies to include potential harm. They don't even have to prove harm, potential harm of an outbreak rather than the actual harm. The new definition of a pandemic will be the global spread of a pathogen or variant that infects human populations with limited or no immunity through sustained and high transmissibility from person to person, overwhelming health systems with severe morbidity and high mortality, and causing social and economic disruptions, all of which require effective national and global collaboration and coordination for its control, end quote. That means that what we just went through for the last 3 years did not have to happen at all. It was not a legitimate pandemic. It wasn't even an epidemic. With a 1% mortality rate, we could have reduced that if we started immediate treatment for people with symptoms and only allowed specific care for those who had comorbidities and were most susceptible. In fact, in almost all the nursing homes, if you notice, they had zero COVID infection until they got the vaccines, then they got COVID from the vaccines, and then they died. So, and all the people with autoimmune conditions should never have been given the vaccine, but they were. Now we're seeing a whole bunch of those autoimmune conditioned people who were stable with the original condition, now with the vaccines and the boosters, now they have an unstable and collapsing systems. So the World Health Organization would be able to say, we're going to give you the input on what to do on every level. Economic disruptions, we've got our advisors. A high death, we've got our advisors. And we're the ones who are going to collaborate with, and we're selecting our collaborators. You don't get to do that. And by the way, they're not saying it, but you can bet that every single scientist, every single person they're going to collaborate with will be under their control. Also, the acceleration of pandemic-related products during emergency that would leap over regulatory hurdles to assure safety and efficacy, like a permanent emergency authorization use on a global scale. You saw how utterly, completely, totally, 100% corrupt the original vaccine mandates were and the manufacture of those vaccines. And now we're reaping the whirlwind. We're having millions of people with adverse events. We have hundreds of thousands dead in the United States, even with our sloppy system, and we have upwards up to a 40% increase in overall mortality above and beyond normal mortality. So if we have a normal year of 1.8 million people dying in America from all causes, suddenly you got 40% more than that. And it only started when the vaccines were given, because they started measuring it, Ed Dow did, and a group of economists from 2016, 17, 18, 19, and 20, normal. Bring in, including with COVID, then bring in the vaccines, up to a 40% increase, and they're not willing to look at this. And these are actual insurance actuaries. So once again, they would determine what is done and when. The treaty would give the World Health Organization unprecedented power over national governments and override all national sovereignty. The supporters of the treaty, like the Biden administration, claim the opposite. But don't believe what anyone in the media tells you, because they're not going to tell you the truth. So what we have is we have the worst overreach, a power grabbing in the history of the United States and, in my opinion, the world, because if this treaty goes forward, every other sovereign treaty will become, that's a part of this, will become completely nullified. Is that an accurate statement of what you've been saying?
I think then it'll be up to the lawyers of which treaty takes precedence. Yeah, but there are very serious concerns when your own government, when Biden wants the WHO treaty to take precedence over our domestic law and our constitution. So that means you can't stop it quickly. You have to go to court. You're looking at procedures that take many months or years. So even if you win in the end, during that time that that it's in the courts, there is probably not going to be an injunction against it, and people will be forced to be vaccinated with experimental products again. They will force to one provision of the IHRs, as amended, with the proposed amendments, is that the WHO will tell you what drugs you can and can't have in the event of a public health emergency. So, you know, if we were to repeat COVID, the WHO would simply say no one is allowed to have vitamin D or, you know, hydroxychloroquine, chloroquine, ivermectin, etc. This is very, very dangerous. I mean, the governments and the WHO are trying to take over the role of the doctor, and there will be no more, you know, doctor-patient relationship, because you won't be able to see a practitioner who can look at your individual situation and make recommendations for how to treat you based on that. Instead, you know, there will be, if you have COVID or if you have, you know, bird flu, this is the drug you get, this drug and only this drug, and the dose we tell you. Now, there are two other really important things I want to mention before we're done. And one is that Jeremy Farrar, his name is, he's a doctor. He's knighted in the UK, Jeremy Farrar, Sir Doctor. In the UK, they pronounce it Farrah. So Jeremy Farrah. He was the director of the Wellcome Trust, which is one of the world's top financiers. You know, it's a foundation for medical research, but it's been co-opted. So it's been basically a source of slush fund for this whole global biosecurity agenda. And Jeremy was central in establishing both the recovery trial in the UK and the solidarity trial that was conducted by the World Health Organization. And in both of these two very large trials, they had a total of approximately 2,600 people take hydroxychloroquine to see if it worked for COVID. But each of these trials gave doses that were three or four times higher than normal and probably caused a number of arrhythmic deaths in hospitalized patients, patients who were so sick they required hospitalization for COVID back in 2020. He has now been asked to leave the Wellcome Trust, and he has become the chief scientist at the WHO. And his job at the WHO is probably to, since he spent most of his career working around the world and particularly in Vietnam, but he travels constantly, his job is to convince the countries of the world to go along with these amendments and the new treaty. He's a very dangerous person, very charming, and we need to be very wary of him. The other thing I want to talk about is the fact that the amendments and the pandemic treaty of the WHO are not the beginning of legal documents that are taking away humans' sovereignty and ability to make choices and decisions about healthcare during pandemics. In fact, the United States has had pandemic preparedness legislation passed since at least 2014. We've spent about $200 billion on so-called pandemic preparedness. A lot of that money went to create gain of function or biological warfare, more virulent microorganisms. Like COVID, you know, some of that money went to pay EcoHealth Alliance and the Wuhan Institute of Technology. Much of it went to Ralph Baric at the University of North Carolina, et cetera. So in the under the guise of pandemic preparedness, we've actually been creating organisms that can cause the next pandemic. And the United States government is still doing that. Last year, they gave actually in late 2021, they gave another $125 million to an organization that Peter Daszak was involved with to continue to search out dangerous viruses all around the world and share them and bring them back so the Defense Department can play with them and see what they can do with them. Now, almost nobody was aware that in the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the bill every 2 years that funds the Defense Department, a bill was snuck in there for pandemic preparedness. And it not only started with $5 billion to be used on this global pandemic architecture, the biosecurity agenda, but it says it's enforceable, that this bill, which was voted on, passed, signed by Biden, enacted, it's now a law, says, quote, any agreement concluded under the authorities provided under this subsection shall be legally effective and binding upon the United States in accordance with the terms of the agreement. So, upon the enactment of appropriate implementing legislation that provides for the approval of the specific agreements or agreement, including attachments, annexes, and supporting documentation as appropriate, or if concluded and submitted as a treaty upon approval of the Senate. So it basically says, in very confusing legal language, and you have to read additional parts of this bill, it says that on the one hand, the Senate could approve these UN documents and then they would be enforceable US law. But on the other hand, there's a method by which the Senate wouldn't even have to approve them and they would still become, they still are enforceable under US law. So while we think, while we've been led to think the danger is in these World Health Organization documents that will not be voted on until either this May or May of next year, in fact, many of the provisions, including One Health, have already been enacted into US law. And they have to, now we have to dig them out and get rid of them. We have to, we've got a new Congress, we have to pass laws that make these things inactive.
All right, that's a good summary. So what do we do? We're at the end of our program. I'm going to give you 2 minutes to give us what can we do to stop this.
So the World Health Organization has a good reputation. You know, it, like Bill Gates, it has been managed to control its, you know, the media that have reported on it. But in fact, it has a really terrible reputation in terms of managing pandemics. So it mismanaged the 2009 swine flu pandemic that was actually milder than a normal flu pandemic. It mismanaged the Ebola epidemic pandemic of 2014 in West Africa and the Ebola epidemic in 2018-2019 in the Eastern Congo. And it mismanaged the Zika epidemic. In fact, it works for vested interests. It has no interest in public health. It has no experience. Tedros is not a physician. They have a very small number of people who are, you know, working with the World Bank, the World Economic Forum, the Pandemic Preparedness Monitoring Board, a small, tiny cadre of people making decisions that affect the health of many millions or billions of people. The whole thing needs to be exposed. And then it can be dissected and the United States can get out of the WHO and other countries can too. And the organization basically needs to die. And then perhaps we can rebuild it so that it does what it's supposed to do, which is take care of tuberculosis and malaria, you know, and problems like that, HIV in countries where the country itself can't manage those problems. The other thing we have to be aware of is that the WHO is simply an instrument that the global elites have chosen to push this global biosecurity establishment down our throats. Even if we get rid of the WHO, the global biosecurity architecture is, a lot of it is already in place, and it is being built with our tax dollars as we speak. And Very few people understand that. And we have to get rid of that. That because they're still working on creating microorganisms that are more virulent and that can cause the next pandemic. God knows what else they're working on.
And Meryl, keep in mind that the largest single individual contributor to the World Health Organization is Bill Gates. And he just acknowledged he made $500 million profit on one of the vaccines or drugs. And then once it shown not to work, as well as he is promoting, then he sold the stock and now says, oh, let's go to another apparatus, another vaccine. It's all nonsense. We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it and look forward to another conversation.
Thank you, Gary.
Dr. Meryl Nass, NASS. And thank you all for joining us today on the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.